I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. Today, we will see whether Republicans stand strong for integrity of our elections, but whether or not they stand strong for our country. Our country. Our country has been under siege for a long time, far longer than this four-year period.
January 6, 2021, with the White House as his backdrop and Congress preparing to certify the election at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, President Trump issued that call to action and a few minutes later ratcheted up the rhetoric.
Something's wrong here. Something's really wrong. Can't have happened. And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
And that is exactly what his supporters did.
Where the f*** are they?
While we're here, we might as well set up a government.
Well, nearly a year later, as a congressional committee investigates the insurrection and holds former White House officials in contempt of Congress, my next guest says January 6th was just practice and that the Republican Party, led by Donald Trump, is in even better shape to subvert the next election. Barton Gellman's big cover story in The Atlantic is headlined, "Trump's Next Coup Has Already Begun," and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to play a montage of tape from Liz Cheney, Congresswoman from Wyoming, on Monday as the committee met to vote to hold Mark Meadows, the former White House chief of staff under Trump, in contempt. And here she is talking about text messages Meadows received from Fox News personalities and even Trump's own son.
The president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote. Quote, can he make a statement? Ask people to leave the Capitol, Sean Hannity urged. Quote, he's got to condemn this ASAP. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough, Donald Trump Jr. texted.
Okay, so you write in your article, which came out before this latest piece of news, that virtually no one a year ago, certainly not I, you're speaking of yourself, predicted that Trump could compel the whole party's genuflection to the big lie and the recasting of insurgents as martyrs. Today, the few GOP dissenters are being cast out, including Liz Cheney. What has changed in the past year?
Well, what has changed to start with is that the immediate reaction after the insurrection, which was a kind of recoiling in shock at what had happened, has dissipated and been completely overridden by a rush among Republican officials to show their loyalty to Trump, to whitewash what happened on January 6th, to declare the people who participated in the riot there to be martyrs and patriots, and to put their full support behind Trump again. So the people like Senator McConnell and Leader McCarthy and Lindsey Graham and others who, on the night of and the day after January 6th, were expressing their shock and horror at what had happened, have forgotten all about that now.
Forgotten or have decided not to think of it that way because it's not in their best interest politically?
Oh, why? I meant forgotten in exactly the sense you just described, yeah.
So what have they been doing practically to ensure that they're more successful this time around, should they need to be? Should they lose the election again? What are they doing to make sure that the court decisions actually go their way this time?
Well, so there are two parallel tracks. They are bowing to and also feeding the mass political movement on Trump's side that is conspiracy-minded and prone to violence. They are continuing to either openly support or to be very careful not to dissent from the false narrative of a stolen election, which is motivating tens of millions of Trump supporters in their action. And by continuing to feed that narrative and by minimizing what happened on January 6th, they're making all that possible.
A recent poll found that more than 60% of Republicans now believe the election was stolen. It boggles the mind, really, that this idea that less than a year ago was seemingly a fringe idea has now taken over the Republican Party.
Yeah, so that's three-fifths of all Republicans. The poll I cited, my story, is from PRI, and that was November 1st, and that showed 68% of Republicans, more than two-thirds, believe that the election was actually stolen. And they believe it passionately. The Republican leadership, the Republican elites, do not, in fact, believe it. If you were able to dispense truth serum to Republican statewide and national elected officials, you would have a very strong majority that acknowledged Biden's legitimate victory. Hardly any of them are willing to say that in public because they're now afraid of this energized base that Trump has created. And many of them are going along with it for opportunistic reasons and even competing with one another to out-Trump Trump. And the ones who are not are simply literally afraid to say otherwise, because they see what happens to Liz Cheney, they see what happens to Adam Kinzinger, and the other people you could fit on the fingers of two hands who have dissented are being driven from the party. At the operational level, the Republican Party all around the country is seeking out every obstacle that got in Trump's way when he tried to overthrow the election last time, and they are rooting out those obstacles. So if it was a county or statewide official who refused to go along with the fiction that Trump had won, they are hounding that official out of the party or out of the job, or they're making the job irrelevant. They're changing the rules so that that job no longer has any authority over certifying an election. They are running people for jobs overseeing the election on the platform that the election was stolen last time and that they would not have certified Biden's victory, notwithstanding all the votes in the state. So they're taking over the jobs of the referees and making sure that there's no one who can stand in their way the next time.
One of the people who is openly calling for that to happen and is encouraging people to do that on the local level is Steve Bannon. He has an incredibly popular podcast, and I just want to play a clip of tape from it from back in May.
People got to understand, the establishment is not going to welcome you with open arms. They're not going to pat you on the head. It's going to be a fight, but this is a fight that must be won. We don't have an option. At the school board level, right, at the county supervisor level, at the precinct level, this is, we're going to take this back precinct by precinct, village by village.
What does he mean by precinct by precinct? What is this precinct strategy?
The strategy is to put zealots who believe the election was stolen in every job that's relevant to the deciding of an election. So you have someone who runs for supervisor of elections in so-and-so township in such-and-such a county in such-and-such a state. There's one in Pennsylvania who is running explicitly, again, on the platform that the last election was stolen and that he is going to be there to make sure the next election isn't stolen, quote unquote. And what these people are giving themselves permission to do is to put their own thumbs on the scale next time it comes to counting the votes.
So all of these, I guess, MAGA soldiers, if you will, are now flooding local counties and saying, I want to be a precinct captain or worker. I want to observe the vote, or I want to count votes. Is that what they're doing?
Some of them are to observe votes. Some of them are to count votes. And this doesn't stay at the precinct level. Trump has seven candidates running for Secretary of State in presidential battleground states who are running, again, on the platform that Biden didn't really win their states. And they, in fact, would like to decertify that victory. There's no such thing under law as decertifying the assignment of electors in the Electoral College, and certainly not a year after the president takes office. But never mind that. They say they're going to decertify, and they're going to make sure that nothing like that happens again.
I think it's easy to look at that and say, well, you know, some of these candidates are just so fringy. How could they possibly get elected? And I'm thinking in Michigan, one of the candidates for Secretary of State is so far out there, it's impossible to believe that she would be elected. She's the one who's been endorsed by Trump, and she's an anti-vaxxer. She opposes teaching evolution. She calls public schools government indoctrination camps. She's got really nutty things to say about the LGBTQ community. So should people take candidates like that seriously?
Well, I think if there's one thing we've learned in the Trump era, it's that you can't afford not to take people seriously. Trump's endorsement is a very powerful thing in Republican politics. And the Trump-endorsed candidate is likelier than not to win the nomination. Michigan is a state that is fairly closely divided between red and blue. The Republican candidate will have a chance. But in other states, the Trump-endorsed candidate has even better chances. I mean, Arizona, Trump's candidate for governor, has also said that she intends to decertify Biden's victory and make sure that the next election is run according to her Orwellian definition of election integrity.
You, in your article for The Atlantic, talked with a few political scientists who drew a historical comparison between Trump and the late Serbian dictator Slobodan Milosevic. And I just want to play a clip of tape from a famous speech Milosevic gave in 1989.
Pre šest vekova Srbija je ovde na polju Kosovu branila sebe.
So basically he's saying, make Serbia great again. And he's drawing on this great replacement style rhetoric when it comes to Muslims. Can you talk a little bit more about how these political scientists see Trump in relation to someone like Slobodan Milosevic?
Sure. So Milosevic, in this speech in 1989, it was the 600th anniversary of a catastrophe in Serbian history in which the Ottoman Turks defeated the Serbs. And Milosevic was standing on that spot and saying, the Muslims are coming to get you again. They are trying to wipe out the Serbs, and we have to fight them. A great moment of national decision has arrived. And in effect, what he did was he gave huge fuel to a fire that destroyed the hopes for a multi-ethnic democracy in the former Yugoslavia. And Trump's speech on January 6th included many of the same themes.
But now the caravans, they think Biden's getting in. The caravans are forming again. They want to come in again and rip off our country. Can't let it happen. As this enormous crowd shows, we have truth and justice on our side. We have a deep and enduring love for America in our hearts. We love our country. We have overwhelming pride in this great country, and we have it deep in our souls. Together, we are determined to defend and preserve government of the people, by the people, and for the people.
These are classic tropes that are used to spur political violence.
Do you think that there will be political violence? More political violence, I guess, you know, aside from what happened on January 6th, but going forward?
What I think is that there's a huge mass of kindling, and it's awaiting the next spark. And this is an observation that was made by Robert Pape at the University of Chicago. There are about 21 million Americans who believe both of two propositions. One is that Biden is an illegitimate president who was not elected by the people. The other is that violence is justified to restore Trump to the White House. And they were asked the question exactly that baldly. Violence is justified to restore Trump to the White House. If you have 21 million people who believe in political violence, and you have political violence embraced by the middle class, by educated people, by older people, because the January 6th insurgents were all of that. They were not the typical young, unemployed, undereducated men who typically have conducted political violence. I think they will know what to do next time Trump tells them, please assemble, which is what he did on January 6th.
And as you have been researching and writing, you don't think that because we look at what happened with his attempts, he lost in almost every court he went into. There were lawmakers and legislators in various states who refused to do his bidding. We can't count on that going forward.
I'm not saying it would be easy for Trump to steal the next election, but he has advantages now that he didn't have last time. Trump was trying to take advantage of the fact that Biden won closely contested states dominated by Republicans in the state legislature. Because under Article 2 of the Constitution, the state legislature is in charge of deciding how electors will be chosen. And Trump wanted the state legislators, the Republicans, in states that Biden won, to throw away the votes of their citizens and to say, we are going to appoint electors for Trump. In order to get away with that, you would also need to have Congress accept those electoral votes, because what was happening on January 6th was that Congress was making the official count of electoral votes. And if there are multiple slates of electors, the Biden electors are sent forward because he won the election in, let's say, Pennsylvania, and there's another slate of electors appointed by the Pennsylvania legislature that are Trump electors, Congress has to decide which ones to count. That was not going to go Trump's way last January 6th because Democrats controlled the House of Representatives. In the 2022 election, it is certainly possible that Republicans will win back both the House and the Senate nationally. And if that's the case, and if there are Republican electors being substituted for Democratic electors on the day it comes to count them, January 6th, 2025, we can't be sure whether those Republican senators and members of the House are going to go with what the voters chose or go with what the legislators chose. But Trump has much more possibility to steal the election under those circumstances.
Assuming he runs.
I do assume he runs.
Well, so meanwhile, you have laid all of this out. And what are the Democrats doing about it? Have they rallied to this five-alarm fire as it has been portrayed?
There are lots of Democrats, big D and small D, people worried about our constitutional order, who are talking about it. They have proposed legislation at the national level that is being filibustered. But I have to say that Democrats at the organizational level and also just at the individual level are not sufficiently energized by this right now. I believe we're in a real Democratic emergency, and the Democratic Party and small D Democrats are not behaving as though they believe that.
What about regular people? Are they focused on this? Because there are a lot of crises that are taking up a lot of people's attention, including a pandemic, including global climate change, including all sorts of things. So this can seem pretty abstract to many people. So how do you get regular voters to think of this as a very important emergency that they should pay attention to?
I don't know how you motivate people. There's an ironic fact in public opinion right now that about one third of Democrats are worried about the future of our democracy and worried about the integrity of elections. And two thirds of Republicans are worried about our democracy and the integrity of elections. And it's their own mistaken beliefs about a rigged election that is the greatest threat that we have right now to democracy. I mean, that's what Trump did. We've never had a president, an incumbent president, or any presidential candidate who refused to concede a legitimate loss. And with that refusal, with that insistence that he really won, he has just set aflame a giant base of people who were disappointed and are happy to believe that the election was stolen. I spent a lot of time in my story and in my reporting with a firefighter in New York City who believes that the election was stolen, who believes that the January 6th defendants are patriots who are being unjustly held in jail. And I engaged him at considerable length, many, many hours over a period of weeks, back and forth, to try to understand why he believes what he believes, and then subject his evidence to scrutiny. And the evidence didn't hold up. He would cite a crazy video on Rumble, the right-wing video site, or he would cite statistics that were just simply incorrect. And when I would come back to him and say, well, here's how the statistics really work, there were not 14 million unaccounted votes, as you think there were. They're accounted for right here. He would just move on to the next thing. He's been the recipient, the consumer of such a volume, a vast volume of propaganda, that he just simply couldn't believe that the evidence was all wrong, that if one thing turned out not to be true, the next thing must be true.
So it sounds like it's an impossible thing, then, to convince someone. It's almost like trying to convince someone about religion or anything else that is essentially unprovable in their minds, that if they're going to believe what they believe, no matter what. And so I guess I'm left wondering what the answer is then. It seems pretty bleak what you're describing is going to unfold.
I think we're going to need to see a new generation of Republican leadership. There are always going to be disappointed voters who feel like they were robbed when the other side won and who are incredulous at the idea, since all their friends agree with them and everyone around them agrees with them, they don't understand how it could be that they lost. That happens in every election. What doesn't happen in every election is that the candidate validates those feelings of disappointment with an extended year-long campaign to prove that black is white and up is down. And we're going to need to see Republican leadership that takes another direction before the Republican electorate is going to agree to be led that way.
Barton Gellman from The Atlantic, where you can read his big piece on, well, it's titled Trump's Next Coup Has Already Begun. Barton, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how Twitter's new audio platform became a haven for racists and terrorists, and why Twitter has done really nothing about it. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Right around the start of the pandemic, a new social media platform called Clubhouse launched. It was invite only, and it offered small virtual rooms where users could talk with each other, something all of us were really missing at that time. Clubhouse soon ballooned to 10 million users, including celebrities like Elon Musk, Tiffany Haddish, even Drake. Naturally, other social media platforms wanted in on that action, including Twitter, which launched a similar audio platform called Spaces last spring. But Twitter Spaces quickly devolved into a place where anti-vaxxers, white supremacists, even ISIS recruiters thrived. And when Twitter discovered the problem, it really did little to stop this hate speech. And worse, in some cases, it actually helped the content go viral. And that's all based on reporting by my next guest, Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Hey there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with just describing what happens in these places like Clubhouse and Twitter Spaces. So for people who don't know what Clubhouse is, how does that work exactly?
Well, it starts with a room. Let's say I want to talk about a certain topic. Let's say I want to talk about Twitter. Okay. I will create a Spaces. It's really easy. I just press a button and say, I want to create a room to talk about Twitter. And then it's an open invitation. And because, you know, I have a good number of Twitter followers as a journalist, a lot of people will just join my room with the click of a button. And then when you join the room, you can hear people talking. It's like you're in a clubhouse and you're chatting. So it's just audio instead of video, just chat about something where the host is the one presenting. And usually it's a panel, but lots of people can just press a button to raise their hand. And so oftentimes there's a lot of participants talking as well.
Okay. And there's just not that much moderation happening. No one from Twitter is sitting in on this and making sure that the talk is okay.
No, there's zero moderation of audio. And, you know, Facebook has an audio product. Clubhouse, I don't know entirely what their rules are or their policies and practices are, but I know Twitter has no real-time moderation. So there's no people. And you got to think, Twitter has nearly 300 million users around the world just using regular Twitter. And they have about 2,000 content moderators. None of those people are listening to audio real time. And then unlike on the regular Twitter, where there is technology that can actually scan for posts that are hate speech or extremist speech or misinformation, there's no technology right now that can scan audio. And I wrote this story because even though this seems like a niche product, like I don't know how many of your listeners have participated in it, these are the products that are what Silicon Valley is pushing for the future. I wrote this story because it seems like as they're pushing into the future, they're making the same mistakes of the past.
So what kinds of things did you discover were taking place? What kinds of conversations did you discover were taking place on Spaces?
Well, I first learned about this story, actually, not from watching Twitter, but from some sources who work at the company, who were telling me, you know, people are having this huge debate right now about supporters of the Taliban. As people may remember, the Taliban, after the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan this summer in August, the Taliban took over. And people were internally at Twitter were noticing that Taliban supporters and fanboys were using Spaces to essentially support and tout the Taliban. People in the company were saying, why don't we have any moderation? And then it started to explode into public view around later in the fall, when you started seeing conversations like ask a white nationalist, or there was one which said black people shouldn't exist. That was the name of a room. And so you can really see, and this is not a surprise, if you talk to any expert in extremism, they'll tell you that extremist groups are very much early adopters of new internet and social technologies. Why? Because A, they get kicked off frequently from the existing ones, and B, you know, just like any social movement these days, it depends on creating like ideologically motivated supporters in far-flung places. And mm-hmm. so you just need to keep the drumbeat going in order to motivate and radicalize people.
So why can't American intelligence agents sit in these rooms and find out what they're talking about and what they're planning?
I did talk to one researcher in disinformation who was tracking the rooms and quoted him. You know, he said when he listened to some of the rooms, you know, he heard a lot of anti-Semitic conversation in the Taliban rooms. I talked to some people, some journalists in Afghanistan who were listening to the pro-Taliban rooms who were saying, and this is, by the way, this is content, a lot of it's in English because it's meant to build support around the world. You know, people were saying that Shiite Muslims should die, that they're not really Muslims. Lots of conspiracy theories about 9/11. Twitter right now does not ban conspiracy theories about 9/11 on its platform. And they allow the official Taliban to be on the platform as well, unlike Facebook. So I'm not saying all this stuff like is a hard and fast black and white line, what people should say, what they shouldn't say on the internet. But there are certain things like hate speech, anti-Semitic speech, saying other groups of people should die. And Twitter itself bans dehumanizing comments about people of different religions or ethnicities. And so if they're banning that stuff, if that's literally in their rules, but they don't have any way to enforce the rules as they're broken, that's what caused this huge internal fight. Hmm. It is ongoing, is my understanding.
So what is Twitter's response to all this officially or even unofficially internally? Is it basically throwing its hands up saying, well, we can't monitor audio the way we can monitor regular Twitter, so oh well?
What they say about audio is that they are working on technology that can start to scan audio, but all the experts I talk to, and Twitter's pretty candid about it too, it's in really, really early days. Scanning audio right now is harder than scanning text. And I thought to myself, that's so weird, because there's lots of automatic transcription services yeah. right now. So it's not that hard to recognize words. Certain slurs you could recognize. Mm-hmm. The other thing Twitter does say is that anybody who listens to Spaces, and you know, anyone can join these rooms, if they hear something, they can report it to the company. And that's how it exploded into public view in the fall. Lots of people were reporting stuff they heard. And then once someone reports it, Twitter, they tell me that they put it to the top of the queue. And then they have a special team of people that will listen to the audio after the fact. The problem is Twitter is only knowing about the hate speech or the extremist speech until after it happens.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they can ban a host. You know, if it's the same host doing stuff over and over again, maybe that host doesn't get that many spaces. But just remember, Twitter allows anonymous accounts. So that host can then mm-hmm. create another account under an anonymous name.
Well, is all this worth it for Twitter? Are they making money off it?
They're not making money off of it right now, but Twitter has been under a lot of pressure from a group of activist investors that basically gained a large stake in the company, campaigned saying that Twitter was sluggish. It hadn't released any new products in years. So Twitter suddenly moved Spaces to the top of the roadmap, And they're pushing out all these new products this year. It's not just Spaces. And then a couple of weeks ago, Jack Dorsey just suddenly resigns. Clearly, like, something happened where he was scrambling to go. And so there's a lot of turmoil at Twitter. And the way that that trickled down was this pressure to put out new products. What somebody told me at the company, who works at the company, said the quote was, ship fast and learn in public. So it's not Facebook's move famous quote, move fast and breaks things, but it's their version of it. Ship fast and learn in public.
Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Always great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, a food critic thought she would have the meal of her life when she walked into a Michelin-starred restaurant in Italy. 27 courses and 4 hours later,
I looked at my husband across the table and I just said, I'm starving. And he said, we all are. When we leave here, we'll get some food.
Her review and the reaction next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. There is something delicious about a terrible restaurant review. Here are the opening lines of a review of a Michelin-starred restaurant named Bros.
There's something to be said about a truly disastrous meal. A meal forever indelible in your memory because it's so uniquely bad, it can only be deemed an achievement.
Yes, the restaurant is named Bros. It's in the southern Italian city of Lecce. And the review's writer is James Beard Award-winning food writer Geraldine De Reuter. Her review for her blog, The Everywhereist, has now gone viral. And De Reuter says over the course of more than 4 hours at Bros, her party was served 27 courses of foams, frozen air, and meat-infused molecules. The experience changed the way she thinks about fine dining and the value we place on high-end restaurants. And Geraldine De Reuter is here now. Hello.
Hi.
Have you gotten over your trauma of your meal at Bros?
I mean, it's going to stay with me. It's a memory and it's a heck of a story.
It sure is.
Yeah.
Well, I guess a lot of people found it a heck of a story because your review went viral. So let's set it up at the beginning. You're in this gorgeous city, Lecce, on the Italian coast, and this restaurant has received a Michelin star. So you think, okay, this is going to be a wonderful fine dining experience. And what happened when you got your first course? Because that's when things began to go awry.
Well, yeah, I was super excited. And first of all, Lecce, to its credit, gorgeous city and fantastic restaurants. I was excited and I was ready. And the first course that came out was kind of this green sort of gelatinous, tiny little crepe. It was, you know, probably about the size of a quarter, maybe a half dollar. And it had sort of raw herbs inside of it. And I thought, well, that was strange. But the thing about a tasting menu, and I always say this, is every course is a chance for redemption. So, you know, maybe the first one wasn't great, but the next one will be better. And at some point I realized, well, this isn't getting better. It's just getting weirder. And a few hours in, I looked at my husband across the table and I just said, I'm starving. And he said, we all are. When we leave here, we'll get some food.
Oh, no. And there were how many courses?
Well, so how do you define a course, really? You know, at this point, it kind of became like a deconstruction of what a course is, but 27 things came out of the kitchen. We know that. That is what we counted. Some of them were, you know, little shots of vinegar. Some of them were paper thin, you know, cuts of what I think was kind of like edible paper. So it varied in size. All of it was very small, but there were 27 of them.
Wow. There's one that you have a picture of, which is really startling. And this is citrus foam served in a plaster cast of the chef's mouth. So the foam is kind of dribbling out of the mouth.
Uh-huh.
What was that?
I know. What was that? Oh, you're asking me. Oh, I have no idea. So, gosh, this dish, if I can call it that, it kind of encapsulated the entire zeitgeist of the meal. So it is literally a cast of both of the chef/owner's mouths. So there were two different casts. One belongs to Chef Floriano and one belongs to Chef Isabella. And they placed the cast in front of you, and it's like, it looks like a circular orb with a mouth. The foam is kind of sitting inside, and it's a citrus foam, and there's a little bit of liqueur in it. And it actually tasted quite nice, very insubstantial, but there was no utensil with which to eat it. So you had to put your mouth up to it and slurp it out, which was, you know, kind of an incredibly vulnerable and awkward experience. And you just had to pray that, like, you didn't accidentally make eye contact with people at the table.
You're slurping from this mouth.
Nobody wants that.
No. Okay, so in their defense, because they did defend themselves after your review went viral.
A rebuttal.
Yeah, so it was three pages. Basically, it was titled Declaration by Chef Floriano Pellegrino. Mm-hmm. And he basically says that he is an artist. And this is what artists do, is they push the boundaries, they push the form, they're experimenting. It's maybe not for everyone. It makes people uncomfortable, but there is a larger purpose here. Is there anything to that?
Well, so first of all, I've thought a lot about this. And you know, what a beautiful thing to be discussing the nature of art as a result of a meal. I think that's inherently great. I think that once I get past the misogyny of his post, because, oh my gosh, it is dripping with it. What I think he does is he makes quite a few legitimate claims about the nature of art, which is, you know, art is uncomfortable. And I think there is something inherently true that art has no boundaries and no requirements. But that's not true of food. Food does have boundaries and it does have requirements. It needs to taste good, especially if you're cooking for another person who's paying for a meal.
basic thing.
Yeah, and it needs to be substantial. And it can be an experience that challenges you and it pushes you. But I don't think it should be patently unpleasant.
But so Michelin gave it a star. And in its review, it said, these tasting menus provide guests with a clear insight into the chef's cuisine, featuring innovative and surprising tasting dishes, many of which are finished with a theatrical flourish at your table, all the way through to the excellent desserts, creative and exuberant in equal measure, exclamation point. Sounds like you did not have that experience at all.
I joked that maybe they had Stockholm syndrome after so many hours there. but I wonder too if it's a little bit a case of the emperor's new clothes, where like everyone loves it and nobody wants to call it out, because if you do, you'll be labeled as ignorant and not getting it, which is precisely what happened to me. You know, I was essentially told that I didn't understand the avant-garde and that I don't understand food. And Chef Floriano's essentially told me I should go eat at McDonald's. It's been interesting. I think people don't want to think that they don't get it, rather than say, hey, you know what? Maybe this isn't executed properly.
And maybe it was a bit of European snobbery. Oh, the American doesn't get what we're doing. They'd rather have a Big Mac.
You know what's funny? I got so much, you don't understand Italian culture and you're too American to understand that, which is hilarious because my mother is Roman and my grandparents are from the region that borders Apulia and I speak Italian fluently. So to sit here and tell me I don't understand a culture that's my own has been kind of a delightful sort of footnote to all of this.
Well, maybe your first clue should have been the name, Bros. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that, I mean, come on. In hindsight, that has really stuck out. But I thought, you know, maybe something got lost in translation. They didn't want to call it Fratellis for some reason. So, but yeah, no, the fact that I had this experience at a restaurant called Bros, I was kind of asking for it, wasn't I?
Geraldine DeReuter writes the blog The Everywhereist, where you can read her review of Bros. Geraldine, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, the three-point shot that cemented Steph Curry's place in basketball history. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Steph Curry made history last night at Madison Square Garden.
Here's Curry for the record. It's good! And there it is! Stephen Curry! The all-time three-point king of the NBA!
The Golden State Warriors point guard broke the record for the most three-pointers made by any NBA player. 2,974. He quickly left the court after making the shot to go hug his mom. Aw. The arena erupted in applause for him. Even the Knicks fans applauded. And here to talk about this is Ben Cohen, sports reporter for The Wall Street Journal and author of the book, The Hot Hand, The Mystery and Science of Streaks. Hello, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right, so fans were anticipating this moment. They thought it would happen during the game. And he needed two, right, to break the record?
That's right. After a long, agonizing week of buildup, he finally got to Madison Square Garden, only needing two three-pointers, which I think at this point Steph Curry could probably do in his sleep.
Well, how many does he usually do during a game?
He averages about five or six per game. And, you know, when he wants a record like this, it was not really surprising that it happened in the first 5 minutes of the game. I mean, it wasn't really all that long ago in basketball history when someone hitting two three-pointers in a game would have been a very big deal. But that does seem like a long time ago now that Steph Curry has revolutionized the game and changed the sport forever.
Well, let's talk about that, because the three-pointer, not a lot of people do it, but why? It seems like a great way to rack up points quickly.
Yeah, it turns out that three-pointers being worth 50% more than two-pointers is this incredible value opportunity that that NBA teams have really seized upon in the last decade. One of the great mysteries and paradoxes of modern basketball is what took them so long. The three-point line has been in existence in the NBA since the 1979-1980 season. That year, three-pointers accounted for about 2% of total shots in the NBA. It crept up to about 22% when Steph Curry was drafted by the Warriors in 2009. And over the last decade or so, it has exploded to the point that threes now account for 40% of all NBA shots. Basically, everybody coming into the league can shoot three-pointers. And that is really one of the profound effects that Steph Curry has had on basketball. And you can feel it when you walk into any gym for any level of basketball anywhere around the world. Kids grow up wanting to be like Steph Curry now. They used to want to be like Michael Jordan and try to dunk, but of course, not many people can do that. Now they want to be Steph Curry, which means they want to shoot from very, very far away from the basket, which you can do at any age. And so, you know, there have been billions of people who have shot a basketball in history. And I think it's very clear now that nobody has ever done it better than Steph Curry.
Wow. Well, the person who did it before him was Ray Allen. Who is he?
Ray Allen is someone who Steph Curry grew up admiring. I mean, Steph is the son of an NBA player, Del Curry, who happens to be a fabulous shooter himself. But if you know, you asked him who were the shooters that really shaped the way that you play outside of someone he happened to live with, it was Ray Allen and it was Reggie Miller, whose record Ray Allen broke. And it was Steve Nash, who now happens to be the coach of the Brooklyn Nets. But Ray Allen, until Steph Curry came along, was probably considered the greatest shooter ever. And, you know, I think it's been about 7 or 8 years now when there's not really much of a debate. In sports, there are incredible debates about pretty much everything, especially in basketball. You know, one of the more ferocious debates is who is the greatest player of all time. There's Michael Jordan, acolytes. I think in Los Angeles, a lot of people would say Kobe Bryant or LeBron James, especially. But when it comes to who is the greatest shooter of all time, there really is no debate and hasn't been for a lot of, you know, for a long time. It's Steph Curry, and there's Steph Curry and there's everybody else. And I think that even Ray Allen and Reggie Miller would say that.
And even Steph Curry himself.
Now I can pride myself on the longevity of getting to that number that, that Ray set, and hopefully pushing it to a number that nobody can reach. We'll see what happens, but that's something that the balance of volume and efficiency for me is the standard that I wanted to set. And I never want to call myself the greatest shooter until I got this record, so I'm comfortable saying that now.
Okay, yeah, he doesn't need any false modesty at all. So how would you compare him to, let's say, a LeBron James in terms of greatness?
Well, they're different, which is one of the reasons their rivalry is so unlikely, and you know, it is the source of such a juicy saga in the NBA over the last decade. I think when you look at LeBron James, his genius is that he makes extraordinary things look ordinary on a basketball court. His combination of size and smarts and physique and skill, you know, he can dominate a game in the way that, like, the greatest players that the NBA has ever seen that's the way that they control the game. It's through their size. I mean, the league has always been dominated by the biggest, tallest, most physically intimidating men on the planet. And I think that is a pretty good way to describe LeBron. What makes Steph Curry such just a remarkable figure in the sports history is that his genius is making ordinary things look extraordinary. Everybody grows up shooting three-pointers, or everybody can at least shoot three-pointers. It's just that nobody has ever done it like him before. And so you have this profound contrast between the two of them, which is one of the reasons why their personal rivalry is so interesting. I mean, the two of them played in four straight NBA finals between 2015 and 2019. You know, they, or 2015 and 2018, they might, you know, meet each other again in the Western Conference playoffs this year. And they have sort of circled each other throughout this whole time. Even though, like, you would never have expected Steph Curry to be like the one true rival to basketball supremacy that LeBron would face in his career.
And the Warriors are looking good this year, right? They're at the top of the Western Conference.
Yeah, they're resurgent. They, you know, they went to five straight finals. They won three championships. They were a real dynasty. They had a bit of a slump. I mean, the last 2 years, they were not that good because of injuries, but they are back atop the league now. And Steph Curry looks as sublime as he ever has.
Ben, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ben Cohen, sports reporter for The Wall Street Journal and author of the book, The Hot Hand, The Mystery and Science of Streaks. Okay, and we wrap up our show today. Just a few more seconds, really, to go to you and ask you for your support. The end of the year is fast approaching, 2 weeks to go, and we're asking, what are you grateful for? Are you grateful for KCRW? If we are on your list, then please give now. Today, you can double your impact, donate now, and help us reach a one-day goal of $25,000. It's a lot, but I think we can get there. We've done that before, and we have some help from one of our board members, Silas Myers. He's going to match it, so that would make it $50,000 for KCRW. Oh, my gosh. That's so much money for us. So you can help us reach that goal by donating right now at kcrw.com or 800-600-5279. We have tons of fabulous thank you gifts there, lots of swag that you can sport to show your pride for KCRW. It's also a great gift. Maybe you're scratching your head wondering what to give someone who has everything. Why not give them a membership to KCRW? And you can also donate to the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank as your thank you gift. So it's really, you'll be doubling your giving in this season of giving, and we can't thank you enough. We really do rely on you. So kcrw.com/give, give for all the wonderful programming, give for KCRW, give for yourself, give for the world. Why not? Give something back. kcrw.com, 800-600-5279. I'm Madeline Brand. It is my pleasure to be with you every day, and I'll be with you again tomorrow.